Matter of state in the interest of ES, can we please have appearances?
Michael Denny, on behalf of ES.
Christina Kersey, the Galt Center, and Miki Kiriai.
Assistant Prosecutor Milton S. Leibowitz, on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Your Honors. Anthony Piero, on behalf of the New Jersey Juvenile Prosecutors Leadership Network, as we hear.
Good morning. Deputy Attorney General Adam D. Klein, on behalf of the Attorney General, as Amicus Curiae.
Welcome, counsel. Justice Solomon is participating in this matter. He is watching the argument, and we'll stay with it, and I appreciate your accommodating us to proceed without him present in court now. One additional matter, I'd ask all parties to rest on the papers with respect to the question that has been briefed extensively on the standard for reverse waiver. We have the issue. There's no need to spend time during oral argument on it. Mr. Denny.
Thank you, Your Honor. Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'd like to reserve a few minutes to respond to the state if necessary.
That's fine.
This case presents the novel issue of which motion must be litigated first in a juvenile delinquency case, a motion to suppress physical evidence or a motion to waive jurisdiction. Once waived, a juvenile is harmed simply by being in adult court, where sentences increase from a maximum of 4 years to a maximum of 20, and where juveniles feel immense pressure to plead guilty. Adult litigation also drags on for years, costing the juvenile his formative time as a young adult. This loss is irreversible. The juvenile also loses his privacy, and the facts and allegations of the case are public as soon as the case is filed in the criminal part, causing more irreversible damage. In order to guard against these harms and to protect the rights of the juvenile to a fair hearing, ES argues that this court should adopt a bright line rule that motions to suppress physical evidence should always be litigated prior to waiver motions, or at least in all cases where they would be dispositive of the outcome of the waiver motion. In other cases where a motion to suppress physical evidence would not be dispositive of waiver, there should be a presumption of holding the suppression motion first. The presumption should be overcome only if the case has adult co-defendants or if it involves an unusually complex motion. This is not a jurisdictional issue. A waiver motion is not a challenge to the subject matter jurisdiction where the question is, can the family part hear the motion? We know that family part has jurisdiction when the juvenile case is filed, and it retains that jurisdiction unless and until it decides to waive it. Specifically regarding ES, his former adult co-defendant has already pled guilty, and there's no longer any reason for his suppression motion not to be heard first in the family part before a possible waiver hearing. This concludes my opening remarks.
Please go ahead.
The reason that I'm asking for this to be limited only to suppression of physical evidence, there's really a number of different reasons. First, suppression of physical evidence is what was at issue in the motion in this case, and I'm not seeking for that to be expanded to another set of facts. Additionally, Article 1, Paragraph 7 of the New Jersey Constitution provides enhanced protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. Practically speaking, if a motion to suppress is granted, there's a clear-cut impact on how the evidence is to be dealt with by that judge. It simply can't be admitted against a defendant in the case. Also, suppression motions are one of the few motions that are preserved for appeal, even if not directly preserved, because they often involve all of the evidence that the state has to use against someone in a prosecution, as was true in this case, where the gun really was the only piece of evidence that the state had. Regarding the harm, it's really twofold. The fact of adult punishment, again, as I said earlier, there's immense pressure for juveniles to plead guilty because first-degree maximum sentences go from 4 to 20 years. Second-degree sentences raise from 3 years to 10 years. And the sentences on murder range from 20, and then instead in adult court, their life. Additionally, there's the possibility for escalating pleas, as I pointed out in the brief. There's no legal prohibition against those being used. And we also know from the social science that I cited that when juveniles plead guilty, They'll do it even if they have good suppression issues because they're bad at making decisions. I think the import of the Miller-Comer-Zuber line of cases is really also true here, that juveniles are bad decision makers. And then second, there's the loss of confidentiality. Once the case is filed in criminal part, it's treated as if it arose there, meaning the case is immediately open to the public, the parties, the allegations. It's all out in the open right away. The reasons given by the Attorney General for why that shouldn't be true, 2A, 4A, 60F, and the case State v. KB, are both inapplicable because they deal with post-adjudication. The reasoning in those cases is that once a juvenile has been convicted, the public has a right to know what serious crime he has been convicted of, and there's a potential deterrent effect for other juveniles if they see that there's been punishment for that crime. Neither of those reasons is applicable pre-adjudication, and there's still the presumption of innocence, and it's impossible to tell who's going to be convicted if all privacy is going to be waived immediately up front.
Tell us what you think is off about the appellate division standard, a general preference for suppression first, but leaving discretion with the trial court as opposed to either a bright line rule or a presumption.
Your Honor, I think bright line rule is much easier for the court to apply. If a suppression motion is filed, then it simply has to be litigated beforehand. And then in terms of presumption versus general preference, the difference between that wasn't really articulated in the appellate division decision. And what I'm suggesting now gives a little more of a framework for how to go about evaluating a request to hold a suppression, a motion to suppress physical evidence before a waiver hearing for the actual juvenile courts. And regarding the factors that I have put forth that would be used in that balancing test, there'd be the existence of co-defendants, or if the motion is unusually complex, meaning that it would involve expert testimony, perhaps, or an unusually high number of witnesses, that would be reviewed, again, for abuse of discretion if it were to be appealed. And I think that the court has the right to do this under the supervisory capacity of the state constitution, the same that was mentioned in NS, to provide more protection at the waiver hearing for the juvenile there. I'd also like to stress that ES does not any longer have an adult co-defendant, and he is just alone in juvenile court. The only reason given by the trial court or by the appellate division was the existence of a co-defendant, so his suppression motion should be heard first.
Questions, anyone? Anything else you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Denny. Ms. Kersey.
Good morning. May it please the court. This court has long recognized the profound harm that accompanies the prosecution of youth when they are charged as adults, and as such has embraced continual emphasis on the need for vital procedural safeguards that reflects the gravity of the waiver decision. In VA, it was rejecting the patent and gross of discretion standard of review. In JM, it was recognizing the unique importance of the probable cause hearing in a waiver setting. And in NH, this court made clear that because of the critical nature of juvenile waiver proceedings, and to ensure fairness at this essential stage, youth were entitled to all discovery in the state's possession prior to a waiver hearing. Permitting ES to challenge illegally obtained evidence is the only logical determination which squares with this constellation of protections. Current jurisprudence is rendered meaningless if a child is prevented from challenging the legality of evidence and then waived on illegally obtained evidence. Waiver has profound harms, and it is the most serious and significant action that the juvenile court is asked to take. The harms that occur are life-lasting. They include the possibility of being housed with adults, a concern that was raised in bedrock juvenile case law as far back as Galt and Kent. But this question begins neither there or ends there. Waived children face greater risk of emotional and physical injury. even when they're not detained in adult prisons and jails. From the moment a waiver motion is granted, a youth is live scanned, receives an adult complaint, and is fingerprinted. They lose the presumption of confidentiality. They lose access to the services that are earmarked for youth in juvenile court. They face sentences in excess of their years lived. Youth who are waived face the enormity of a system that was not designed for them. And there's cascading consequences that occur. Convictions that bring additional grave concerns, the ability to work, vote, obtain housing and governmental benefits. Convictions bring collateral consequences that make expungement and the return back to society even more difficult. As with the rest of the country, Black youth in New Jersey bear this burden disproportionately. At a waiver hearing prior to the court's review of the factors, the court must be satisfied that the prosecutor has met the burden of demonstrating probable cause for an offense subject to waiver. The PC hearing in youth court is more robust. That was recognized in JM. Given its potential procedural consequences, a probable cause hearing and a juvenile waiver proceeding is a more critical step in the process than a typical probable cause hearing available to adult offenders. That's why youth are represented at these hearings. That's why they can present evidence. That's why they can testify. That is why they're entitled to full and complete discovery. It's the defender who stands in the gap to ensure that these rights are protected. The right to representation to counsel is not a formality. It is the essence of justice. A robust, contested probable cause determination with inquiry into the admissibility of evidence is the best resource to ensure judicial economy. Requiring that the decision be based on legally attained evidence is a vital procedural safeguard that reflects the gravity of a waiver decision. We respectfully ask this court to reverse the appellate division's decision and remand ES for a motion to suppress in the juvenile court setting and to provide guidance that the children facing waiver to come have the right to challenge and move to suppress illegally obtained evidence.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Leibowitz.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The state requests three things from Your Honors today. First, that this court reverse the ruling of the appellate division, namely that trial courts should apply a presumption that motions to suppress should occur before waiver motions. Second, we would ask that this court adopt a bright line rule that waiver motions should be heard before motions to suppress in a juvenile setting. And third, that this court affirm the appellate division's finding that the trial court in this matter did not abuse its discretion in scheduling the waiver motion before the motion to suppress in this case. The first two points are intertwined. The state requests that you reverse the appellate division's ruling because it's based on speculative harms that are unlikely to occur. It is unnecessary and it is untenable and unworkable in reality. However, because the trial court's request for guidance is why we are here, merely reversing the appellate division's ruling is not enough. The state also requests that you create a new rule requiring courts to consider waiver motions before motions to suppress once a waiver motion is filed. This rule is consistent with the preliminary jurisdictional nature of waiver proceedings and with the legislature's 60-day filing requirement for such motions. It ensures clarity and consistency across the state, and it enables the parties, witnesses, and victims to understand the posture of the case, and also because it protects judicial resources at large. Finally, the state asks that you affirm the appellate division's ruling that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in this matter, because applying either the appellate division's rule or the state's rule, it is clear that the trial court properly held the waiver motion should occur first. Indeed, the only fact that defendant points to is one that did not exist at the time of the ruling, namely that his co-defendant has since pleaded. It's respectfully submitted that this doesn't change the fact that the original ruling was sound. Things that occurred thereafter the fact could not have been considered, and thus it doesn't make it erroneous. Perhaps a motion for reconsideration would have been appropriate, but reversing that ruling and finding it was an abuse of discretion is not. Unless your honors have any questions or would like me to go in a specific order, I intend to address each of the points in the order that I have just presented them. As to why the appellate division's ruling is wrong. First, it's contrary to the statutory structure, Waiver is a question of jurisdiction. It's a threshold issue. Will this court consider this case, or will the law division ultimately preside over the trial that is going to occur? Motions to suppress address admissibility of evidence at trial for conviction. The exclusionary rule looks towards evidence at trial, not at these preliminary hearings. And because a motion to suppress is unlikely to change the outcome of a waiver motion, there's no need to presume to have it go first. The evidentiary rules are relaxed in waiver motions. And as the appellate division recognized in BT approximately 50 years ago, the use of evidence at a waiver hearing that's subsequently suppressed does not violate due process. For these reasons, there is no need to have a presumption that motions to suppress occur first. The appellate division's ruling also was incorrect and should be reversed because it's based on unrealized harms. Foremost, the appellate division recognized that the harms set forth are all potential, that they do not necessarily occur in every case. They used the term may and not shall. And the state submits, most likely these harms will not occur. Loss of services does not occur upon waiver, but occurs upon conviction and adjudication of, or a conviction for a waivable offense. It's not just any offense. There's an automatic remand provision that's already built into the statute that protects juveniles who are waived but not convicted of a waivable offense. They are unlikely to be transferred to an adult facility. Although,
is there any reason why a suppression hearing in the juvenile court is going to be any different qualitatively from a motion to suppress in the law division? Or should we look at those as that they will play out in pretty much the same way in either court?
They should play out the same way in either court, as both judges are judges of the law division, are adjudicating the facts based on the law of the state. So they should result in the same manner. And I believe the appellate division, in reaching its rule, commented upon the equal positioning of both family court judges and law division judges in the criminal part, who both hear these matters in other cases. The state would also push back on the assertion that there's a coercive effect after waiver. Juveniles have competent counsel. If a motion to suppress is truly as important as defense counsel suggests, that it would undermine probable cause, the juvenile shouldn't plead, because if we can't establish probable cause, there's no chance that they will be convicted. And if the juvenile would like to test it, competent counsel who advises them, family members who may also advise, would alert them not to do so. As far as publicity, that can be solved by way of protective orders. It is not necessary to move motions to suppress in advance with the hopes or assumptions that this will decrease the number of waivers that occur. I'd also like to point out that I believe that many juveniles are over 18 by the time that they are waived. And although they may have committed the offense as a juvenile, they are substantially similar in making decisions whether or not to plead guilty as their adult co-defendants who are in the late teens. So as we are not obligated to have motions to suppress prior to grand jury, I'd submit there's no reason to have motions to suppress here, where a juvenile's rights are amply protected by the hearing at a waiver hearing.
First factor for a judge to consider is the nature and circumstances of the offense. Can a suppression motion that's granted affect the weight that that factor would be accorded in the analysis?
I do not believe so, Your Honor, as the nature and circumstances of these offenses are generally victim-based crimes and not possessory offenses. So while a motion to suppress may ultimately lead to, say, a physical gun no longer being admitted at a trial, as far as whether or not a gun was used, the victim presumably would be able to testify that a gun was pointed at me, and this could be admitted through hearsay at the waiver hearing, and the judge can consider it. While suppression may go towards likelihood to conviction, which is something the Attorney General requires prosecutors to consider, that's not one of the enumerated factors that's in the statute for waiver hearings that courts consider in evaluating it.
So it certainly goes to likelihood of conviction, of course. But if you have a case that rests largely, if not entirely, on the suppression motion, a gun case where the gun is suppressed, doesn't that have some bearing on the nature and circumstances of the actual offense that the judge is considering?
Respectfully, I would disagree, because again, the facts of the case are what they are. The nature and circumstances are a gun was used. The state may not be able to admit that item, but it doesn't change that a gun was used, a statement, a confession by a juvenile that they committed the crime, if it potentially will get suppressed, still exists. And if the juvenile were to take the stand at trial and claim that he never confessed and didn't do it, he'd be permitted to be impeached with that. So even motions to suppress may not necessarily prevent the state from using that evidence in all cases. So I would submit that nature and circumstances is slightly different than likelihood of success on the merits, and therefore it would not fundamentally alter that such that it should occur first.
On the question of judicial economy, how many cases a year are at stake?
In the entire scheme of state of New Jersey, I believe less than 1,000. In Union County, I think we had in the high teens last year, of which many were remanded. However, while the numbers may not sound significant, having to file all of these potentially consider all of these pretrial motions would take time away from other juveniles who are not waivable that clearly should be before the court.
Help us with the upper limit. You had fewer than 20 cases in Union last year.
I believe so, yeah.
And you're projecting under 1,000, but by that measure, it would be substantially under 1,000.
Yes, sir.
No? Can you give us a better estimate, or can you?
I cannot give you a better estimate. I understand that the latest, I believe it's JJC report came out showing that there had been, I think, an increase in waivers from the first report that was issued. And to predict what next year will be, I unfortunately can't give you a reasoned basis. One of my colleagues may be able to do so better. But as far as the absolute number of cases, even on the high side, I would feel uncomfortable, as I would not want to mislead the court.
You mentioned in your opening statement several times that the appellate division decision should be reversed because it imposed a presumption. Is that what the court did?
The court ultimately left it to the trial court's discretion, stating that there should be a presumption to have motions to suppress occur first, provided the number of co-defendants wasn't there. And
was it a presumption or a preference?
I'm looking at page 18, where it announces its conclusion using the language that Justice Pierre-Louis just gave you, a general preference with discretion left in the trial court. Not a presumption.
Is your adversary advocating for a presumption, given that that term wasn't used in the appellate division decision?
I believe general preference and presumption are almost a distinction without a difference, and I believe that he actually is requesting for a bright line rule to also depart from the appellate division's ruling.
So let's just talk about your position, because a presumption sets up a construct that needs, and the presumption needs to be overcome. Do you read the language of the appellate division to set up that construct? Or does it give greater flexibility to the trial court?
I think it gives slightly greater flexibility, albeit not much. I think in expressing many of the principles underlying this, the appellate division's ruling makes clear that suppression motions should truly go first, although it isn't a requirement and leaves it with their discretion. It is carefully crafted. I think the actual implications of this are no different than a presumption which the state will essentially have to overcome.
Was this a recurring controversy in the juvenile courts and the criminal courts? Or is this something that came out of nowhere in terms of which motion should go first?
This came out of nowhere, Your Honor. My understanding is that waiver had always gone first before this. And I believe in the court's ruling on page 41, the court references that in reaching its conclusion at the trial level, it spoke to its colleagues, and they all routinely would grant waiver or consider waiver motions first before motions to suppress. So this was something that the state had never come across before.
That didn't sound like a terribly scientific survey that was done.
I admit
Are
it was,
you suggesting otherwise?
I admit it was not, though. I do not know the number of judges that were inquired. I do not know how many people were spoken to. It did seem like an informal polling.
I'm still wondering about your judicial economy argument, because if you're correct in responding to my earlier question that suppression hearing isn't going to be much different from court to court, then what are we saving? What time is being saved? Or is it just a matter of juvenile judges are too busy and criminal judges are not, and it's better to push those hearings off on the law division judge?
So I'm glad you asked, because this brings me to the last point, which was untenability. The policy that was adopted by the appellate division begs many questions. It asks, how will this be enforced throughout the state? If Camden is more likely to waive someone because of overcrowding in Camden because they have more waiver hearings than, say, Union County, is that fundamentally fair? If there are co-defendants, should a juvenile suddenly be permitted to, or not be permitted to have their motions to suppress in the family part, but someone who committed a crime by himself suddenly gets more rights and more protections? What would happen if a juvenile doesn't file a motion to suppress? Are they then forever foreclosed from doing so? As they've indicated, it's really not relevant to establishing probable cause. If they file a motion at the 11th hour, the day before the hearing is set to proceed, should it be considered, or should the waiver hearing be told? If they prevail with their motion to suppress, and the state elects to file a motion for leave to appeal, which is granted, how much longer will that case have to languish before waiver is heard, something that has to be filed within 60 days? What if the state doesn't seek to utilize contested evidence? In that scenario, should there be a motion to suppress at all before, because the state never intended to use it at the probable cause hearing? Essentially, by creating this rule, the court is effectively ceding its calendar to the juvenile to determine how many motions should be heard first, what motion should be heard first. The motions set forth by the appellate division run the gamut of every type of motion to suppress, and respectfully, I'm not sure it requires it be one of those motions. I understand they identified it as motions to suppress, but this could lead to multiple filings before waiver hearings. So judicial resources in that regard, this isn't necessarily one motion that will be heard, one motion to suppress. It could be DNA. They could seek to suppress physical evidence. They could seek to suppress an identification. Perhaps there's a fresh complaint witness and they want to suppress the testimony related to that, or a Bruton issue because there are co-defendants. The practical implications of how this will be enacted, if it's not a bright line rule, and I'm not advocating that Your Honor's advance defendant's bright line rule, are unworkable. They will lead to wildly inconsistent results based on facts of the case, venue, calendar load. It's for that reason that the state would submit that this rule just does not work. It also seems unnecessary because of the limited effect on the waiver hearing. To depart from what was the original status quo, abuse of discretion. This was a scheduling issue. Courts, as the appellate division recognized, have discretion to calendar motions as they saw fit prior to the appellate division's ruling. The appellate division departed from it, finding that there were harms and relied upon it. And the state submits that those harms were not a sound basis for such a ruling. To justify deviation from that, either party, the state or the juvenile, need to identify a good cause, good reason to do so. And I would submit everything that the juvenile has offered either is an unrealized harm or unlikely to occur. Worst case scenario that respectfully shouldn't be used to make the rule, or won't really affect the outcome of that probable cause hearing and will have no meaningful impact on a waiver decision. I'd also note that
from your description, it sounds as though this is but a ministerial decision that's being reached. Is that a fair characterization of what you're suggesting to the court?
It is far from a ministerial decision, but it is a decision made where a defendant has competent counsel, has his rights protected by having discovery, can present his case and his arguments. As Your Honor, if Your Honor disagrees with my assertion that the nature and circumstances of the offense wouldn't be affected by a suppression hearing, I would submit that the juvenile can alert the court to these issues at the waiver hearing. They can present issues as to why probable cause might not be reached, why the court should consider that the nature and circumstances aren't what they appear to be. So it's not as though not having these motions to suppress alters the juvenile's ability to present that argument. They still can do so. All it does is prevent the court from reaching a ruling regarding the admissibility of evidence at trial, not at a probable cause hearing, but at trial. And it's for that reason, that's one of the main reasons the state would submit that there is no benefit in having motions to suppress heard first, because it doesn't change what happens at the waiver hearing. It doesn't change our waiver decisions. And the waiver hearing is a court's review of a prosecutor's evaluation of these factors and of the statutory considerations. But it's not a decision whether or not to waive the juvenile in the first place. It's, did the state abuse its discretion in doing so? And I submit that that nuanced standard further explains why motions to suppress aren't relevant or should not be litigated first. As long as we've considered the issues that are being raised by the juvenile and reaching our conclusion, although our decisions may differ, that's not an abuse of discretion. That's just lawyering, and that's part of our process. The state would ask that you adopt a bright line rule having waiver motions go first because, as I stated before, Your Honor, it appears to be the de facto standard that occurred prior to this case. It's consistent with the legislative intent that waiver motions be filed within 60 days, absent good cause. Waiver is a threshold issue, and the purpose of waiver is to determine if a juvenile should be treated as an adult. Part of being treated as an adult is having your motions heard before the law division. It's being similarly situated to an adult. We do not have motions to suppress before grand jury proceedings. So in essence, by having a motion to suppress here, it would be before waiver, before the state is required to present to a grand jury, before a new detention hearing may be held. It essentially turns the entire procedure on its head for a juvenile who has adequate protections at the waiver hearing and beyond. And it's important to note that there are protections beyond. If a juvenile is not adjudicated or is not convicted of a waivable offense, there's an automatic remand. Much of the harms that the juvenile highlights occur upon conviction for a waivable offense. If they've been convicted of a waivable offense, it's clear that a motion to suppress, which would have been adjudicated prior to that trial, had no effect on the result, that it did not undermine probable cause. And I'd like to draw this court's attention to what the juvenile uses as their prime example, a scenario where a motion to suppress undermines the state's ability to establish probable cause. That is by far the worst case scenario that can be presented for the state, and I would probably pick it too if I were defense counsel. That being said, those aren't the cases that we seek to waive. These are victim-based crimes, usually with a lot of evidence to support same. They do not rely upon one piece of evidence. This isn't a possessory offense or a possessory case. This actual fact pattern in this scenario is quite unique in that it's almost possession adjacent. It's possession of a weapon for an unlawful purpose. But even if a motion to suppress were granted in this case, it's my understanding there's a video showing the events at hand, we still might proceed with a waiver. We might not, as the co-defendant is no longer in the case, but those are things that we would evaluate. But the motion to suppress, I assure you, is not dispositive. And it's not dispositive in many cases. So to assume that it will be in the majority of these, such that it warrants adopting a new rule requiring us to have motions to suppress in every case before waiver, or more often than not, I submit is unnecessary and not useful.
Outside of cases where it's dispositive, the motion would be dispositive, is there any place in the calculus for whether to seek waiver from the prosecutor's perspective where a motion to suppress would factor in at all?
We always consider that as part of the likely under the Attorney General's guidelines. We are obligated to do so, and I think ethically we should not be proceeding with cases if we do not think we have a good faith basis to file that motion to contest the motion to suppress.
But not for the court.
It's not explicitly set forth in any of the factors enumerated in the statute that I can tell. As far as it touches upon probable cause, given the relaxed rule of evidence, I would submit that even if evidence is suppressed, it doesn't necessarily require consideration of same. So I would say no, Your Honor.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, Mr. Leibowitz?
I'd reiterate that under the appellate division's rule or the state's rule, which clearly is would have the waiver hearing go first. It is clear that the trial court's ruling was not an abuse of discretion. And on that, I have no further comments, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Klein, I have you listed as next. Mr. Klein, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. So I'd like to make two points. The first is that the federal part should generally proceed with waiver rather than hold hearings on potential motions to suppress. And I'd like to address some of the guideposts that I believe family court judges should apply when making that case-by-case sequencing decision. And during this part, I'm also going to touch on the Chief Justice's questions about the nature and circumstances of the offense vis-a-vis the potential dispositive nature of a suppression motion. And then second, briefly, I'm going to touch on our position that if a waive or adult co-defendant has charges stemming from the same criminal episode, and he's moved to suppress the evidence, or he's noted his intent to move to suppress the evidence, waiver should always occur first in that circumstance. So I want to pick up with the question that the Chief Justice asked about what's wrong with the appellate division's general preference for holding suppression hearings before waiver hearings. And I think a lot more oxygen needs to be given to the idea that the legislature intended for this to be a quick, expedited process when waiver would be heard and the threshold determination of subject matter jurisdiction would be addressed. And that's particularly so with this statute and in this setting, more so even than in the many cases going back many years in the New Jersey and United States Supreme Courts. So look to the 60-day timeline. This is extended for good cause shown. But 60 days, that's clear, that's a clear indication that the legislature wanted waiver to happen quickly, and it's very difficult to reconcile the appellate division's preference with the idea that the prosecutor is supposed to be evaluating and assessing mitigation evidence and closely examining the 11 waiver factors and the AG guidelines, and at the same time defending against all these pretrial motions, or at least facing the specter of these challenges. So,
Mr. Klein, is your argument that's just too much for the court to deal with at once? If they're under the appellate division's rule, it's an overwhelming for the court, or what's the problem?
I think it goes beyond that, Your Honor. I think looking at the statute, looking at the legislative history of the statute, which discusses the streamlining nature of the process, which got rid of the amenability hearing for judicial waiver, and the idea of the 60-day time frame is that the legislature wanted this to happen in an expedited fashion. And it's not, although it is true that it will be an additional burden, it will burden judicial economy somewhat, the real fact of the matter is that the appellate division's decision acts as an override on the legislature's intent to streamline this thing, to streamline and expedite this process.
You keep saying streamline and expedite, and I think the Chief Justice asked a similar question earlier. It's as if you're viewing this process and the waiver proceeding as a really minor event, and I think we would all agree that it's not a minor event, and because of the implications of a juvenile being waived to adult court and the stiffer penalties that they face, there are a significant amount of protections that the juveniles have. So I'm not sure if that's what your argument, but you know, your argument that this needs to be a quick and expedited process doesn't really square with our case law and all the protections that the juvenile has because this is a really important and significant hearing, correct?
Your Honor, I agree that it is an important and significant hearing, and that's precisely why it should be the focus rather than other motions during that first time period that's allotted for the prosecuting attorney to evaluate whether or not to waive the case, because it is significant and because so much work is involved with that particular portion of the case. And I want to touch on
So it's not just a quick and easy hearing that is done, you know, relatively, you know, quickly, as you've been saying. There is a lot of work that goes into it. It's an important hearing. Just wanted.
I mean, certainly, Your Honor, to be sure, it is an important hearing. We recognize the gravity associated with waiver. We take it seriously. But we nevertheless read the statute and read the legislative history to have intended to expedite the process for certain juvenile offenders. And that does require a lot of consideration from the prosecutor, who shouldn't be saddled with the task of handling all these pretrial motions within that 60-day timeline. If I could touch on a few of the judicial economy concerns that were raised, I think it is foreseeable, you know, just to quote a line from the appellate division's decision, these motions will run the gamut from physical evidence, police interrogations, witness statements. So it's foreseeable that there could be a lot of motions and then appeals of motions and waiver cases, which, again, that is not what was intended when the legislature wrote we want to streamline this process. And likewise, if the state, if non-essential evidence is suppressed before a waiver hearing, the state often takes leave to appeal, and that's ordinarily granted under the appellate division's precedent. That could bring the process to a standstill, and it could generate a lot of unnecessary litigation that could just as well be resolved by holding the motion to suppress after the waiver hearing. So I want to touch on some of the guideposts and also get to Chief Justice Ravner's question about the nature and circumstances of the offense and the dispositive nature of the motion. So there are two kind of categories to consider when family court judges are deciding whether to proceed with waiver before the motion to suppress or vice versa. So in the first category would be judicial efficiency and potential for delay, the latter of which would cut against the statutory purposes I mentioned. And then the second category would be fairness and suppression motion considerations.
As you do with the question of judicial efficiency, can you help us with the overall number of cases in a year in the state?
Yes, so just correct me if I'm wrong in what I'm assuming, Your Honor, but I'm assuming Your Honor is asking for the overall number of juvenile delinquency matters that were docketed in a particular year?
Suppression motions in those matters.
So, candidly, Your Honor, I looked high and low to try to find that information. I was not able to find that. But that is unfortunately not something that I was able to dig up from any source, number of suppression motions. Getting back to some of those factors, I think the family court judges should be considering, is the motion to suppress going to interfere with the expeditious prosecutorial assessment of the 11 waiver factors, of the factors under the AG guidelines, which will be informed by the number of suppression motions filed, the complexity of the motion or motions filed? Is it foreseeable that the state or defendant will move to appeal? Again, something that could slow up the process unduly, that's not what the legislature intended, and that's something that we would discourage. Now, the Chief Justice brought up something that relates to
Can I stop you on the appeal issue? Because how do you view the appellate division's rule applying to appeals? There's no suggestion that I'm aware of that everything stops while the interlocutory process moves forward. Is there?
Not unless it's state, but I think that generally, if the state is moving for leave to appeal an order suppressing evidence pre-waiver and doesn't want to go forward with waiver until that's resolved, that would probably constitute good cause for an extension of the waiver motion. So I think it would throw a bit of a wrench into the whole system in that respect. And those motions are ordinarily granted. But going back to those factors vis-a-vis suppression and fairness, so I think a key thing for judges to consider, and I do take issue with what the defense said in this case as to this first factor, is this motion to suppress one of the lion's share of suppression motions that are complex, which tend to the waiver cases that are complex. These the outcome of the motion to suppress won't be dispositive as to the PC determination. So in this case, we don't only have a gun. There's the testimony of the officers and body worn camera and surveillance footage, this is all on the record. So suppression of the gun would not be dispositive in this case. It would not be dispositive. And the second thing is, is this one of the, and this is what family court judges should consider, would this be one of those rare cases in which the motion to suppress would be dispositive? So I take the example of a carjacking case with a fingerprint placing the juvenile defendant at, as the accused. I think that could be a factor, that could be a factor in deciding whether that general waiver first preference could be overcome. But I think one difficult part about deciding whether it's dispositive is it's happening so early in the proceeding that the cases are often still being investigated. It's going to be very hard to tell based on the investigation if, in fact, that single piece of evidence will be dispositive of probable cause. Now, the Chief Justice's question about the nature and circumstances of the offense, in my view, a pretrial ruling on the admissibility of evidence does not go to the nature and circumstances of the offense. It doesn't affect that factor. That factor goes to what exactly happened, how did it happen, but not necessarily what evidence happened with.
Mr. Klein, take that for a second. In the applications that the prosecutor files, there's generally a narrative description for the different factors to present a fulsome record for the court to make its decision. Under A, it goes beyond simply saying this case is about, as you've just indicated, this case is about possession of a firearm in an unlawful manner. It usually gets into the facts as well, correct?
Yes, correct. Yeah, yes.
So would it be different if that statement were completed after suppression? You might be faced with a circumstance where the initial version would be individual possessed this weapon. This weapon had hollow point bullets. And there was one in the chamber. It was located here or there within access of the individual's reach and so on, as opposed to the very same application setting forth the nature and circumstances under A, where it would be, the charge is a firearms offense, but the firearm will not be introduced based on the family court's granting of the motion to suppress.
Well, I think the heart of the question is, are we going to extend the suppression, assuming the state isn't appealing the motion to suppress, are we going to extend that into the nature and circumstances of the offense factor?
So does
I don't think it should. Does
it have no bearing in light of the manner in which nature and circumstances is currently presented to the court? Does the fact of suppression have no bearing on that?
Well, I think the fact of suppression only has bearing insofar as the judge is evaluating probable cause, and that the prosecutor, it would be unethical and it would be unfair for the prosecutor to say, to try to admit, evidence that they admit that they're not appealing the exclusion of at the probable cause portion, but not with the nature and circumstances of the offense. I think the report, the portion of the suppression portion of the ruling does not extend to retroactively change the nature and circumstances of the offense. I think, I'm not sure that's, I think that may be a bit of a strange reading of that particular factor. But in any event, I did want to just very briefly touch on Judge Bishop's question about, is there a concern with judicial economy? And I do want to emphasize that, there should be a hard and fast rule that when there is a juvenile defendant who's in waived, one of the law division or co-indictee, there is already a presumption in place under Rule 3:5-7C that motions to suppress be consolidated and heard together. But when there are you know, juveniles in different courts and different divisions, there's the potential not just for inconsistent rulings, but inconsistent credibility findings, and nobody wants that. And, you know, I think that that counsels against having them heard separately in any event. With that, I just wanted to highlight before I conclude one final thing that came out in the recent juvenile waiver report, which was that there was a great reduction in the racial disparities that were mentioned in the 2016-17 juvenile waiver report. So I think that's something that all of us can agree is a very good thing. And with that, I would end with asking the court to affirm the judgment of the appellate division to transpose the preferred order of proceedings in a way that aligns with the intent of the legislature and the text of Section 3641.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Mr. Pierre.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Your Honor, I would submit that the remedy as suggested by the JPLN is the, it best aligns with the interests of the state in proceeding in regard to waiver proceedings, as well as the interest of the juvenile by having this considered as an enhanced factor to the already existing waiver factors as outlined in the statute. I would submit it also best aligns with the legislative intent to streamline the waiver proceedings, but to do it in a way that requires a prosecutor and the state to intentionally review that evidence. I would submit to the court that's happening already, but the addition of an enhanced factor to talk about what the state is perceiving to be the likelihood of conviction, I would submit solves the issue at hand, waiving the right cases, making sure that the cases that are removed from the family division are the appropriate cases getting to the law division. And I would submit that an enhanced review, which a court could then look at, if a prosecutor were to submit that there are no suppression issues in this case, discovery has been provided to the defendant. Discovery has been provided to the court. This court's wisdom in NH made that so. That can be challenged at the waiver proceeding without conducting suppression hearings first and getting into some of the harms that I would submit would occur if that were the process as set forth by this court. I want to speak for a minute about the waiver process, and I think, Chief Justice, it goes to your question. Prosecutors take waiver seriously. Of all of the cases that are filed in juvenile court, there were 111 waivers filed in 2019. It is a very small percentage of the number of cases. And while that seems to be a low number, these are the most complicated cases that exist in the family court. They come with the most evidence. They come with the most potential for hearing. So while we talk about a suppression hearing as if that's one piece of evidence, that may not be the case. The large majority of waiver cases are homicides, armed robberies, aggravated sexual assaults. These are cases that have evidence. And if suppression hearings, in using that term broadly to discuss really any motion that could in some way defeat the state's case, we are talking about a large number of motions. And I would submit that innate in this process is the prosecutor's consideration of, can we prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt? I wrote it in the brief, but I submitted to the court. And there's no reason for a prosecutor to take the effort that it takes to file a waiver motion and to conduct a waiver hearing. I've had waiver hearings that have taken 2 to 3 days because of the volume of evidence that were used to establish probable cause, as well as the other procedures of juveniles calling witnesses and testifying as they're entitled to do. These are serious proceedings. And as far as the JPLN is concerned, a serious consideration of can you win this case is appropriate. But we need to do it without having those hearings. Again, I'll get into the harms that I would submit exist as well as the judicial economy. But to answer the Chief Justice's question, in terms of the nature and circumstance of the offense, I would submit that suppressed evidence would not be considered there. And I would suggest that because the nature of the offense, not every first degree crime is waived. That's what that factor is trying to get to. Why this first degree? Why this carjacking? Why this homicide and not that one? That's what that factor should entail. Why has the prosecutor determined that this juvenile, based upon these facts, is moving for waiver when it doesn't occur in every case? And I think that's fair for the prosecutor to do, to individualize based upon these facts. Maybe the age range of between the defendant and the victim is extreme. Maybe this homicide is committed in an especially egregious manner. Maybe this armed robbery is committed in a certain way and this one is not. There are differences within the range. That is what I would submit the nature and circumstances get to. What case are we talking about? Why, of all the first-degree cases that occur in the state, why did the prosecutor select this one? I do, however, think that having a prosecutor consider whether or not the evidence is admissible is appropriate. It's innate in the process. It should be. It should be. And I would submit to the court that adding that as an enhanced factor of the statement of reasons, number one, is, of course, within this court's authority, but number two, solves one of the main concerns raised by the juvenile, that cases are being waived for no reason other than leverage, which I would submit does not occur. These waiver motions are also, prior to being submitted, reviewed by a county prosecutor or a county prosecutor designee in every county. These are not motions that are filed by a junior assistant prosecutor who doesn't understand juvenile practice, who doesn't understand how serious waiver is. These are filed after a consideration of a lot of evidence. These 11 factors at times produce a lot of reports and a lot of evidence for the prosecutor to consider. Some of the psychological information that's available is extremely lengthy, and it takes an experienced person to do it, to review it, to understand it, and to then articulate it to a court as to why that factor was considered to support waiver or to not support waiver. And I would submit that's happening in this state. I'm happy to report that. I would submit that me and my colleagues, when we discussed this at our meetings, that is happening around the state. Because of that construct, I would submit to this court that in a waiver context, due process requires a bright line rule. It requires a bright line rule that waiver proceeds first for three reasons. Number one, it's consistent with the legislative intent. And I will obviously discuss that. Number two, it creates uniformity across the state that any other system put forth to this court would honestly not do. And I'll get into some practical implications. And it solves all of the practical issues that have been raised in all of the briefs submitted to this court. And it allows for judicial efficiency to remain. And I'll start with consistent with the legislative intent, because the legislative intent, of course, was to streamline the process. They say that. But legislative intent was also to make prosecutors review the case. That's what the 11 factors do. It considers that juvenile, that person. It's not just it's a homicide and therefore we're waiving it. It's this type of homicide, it's this type of case, this is how the person presents to the court, this is the number of prior adjudications, this is the manner in which the crime was committed. I've reviewed their substance abuse history, their mental health history, and now we're moving in waiver. So it's intentionally done. So yes, the process is streamlined, but within that and within those construct and bounds, it's done intentionally and purposely by a prosecutor. But the legislature also considered, because of the time frame, there may be cases that are waived that in hindsight should go back to the family court. One of those may be suppressed evidence. One of those may be witnesses are no longer available. One of those may be that after review and process, which does typically take several years to get from juvenile docket to adult conviction, maybe circumstances have changed. And the legislature's solution, understanding that that happened, was reverse waiver. It was not to put into place these other structured proceedings prior to waiver. The legislature knew it would happen. This court knew it would happen. It discussed it in a number of opinions, talking about the finality of waiver. And that was one of the issues prior to 2016. This waiver decision was final. Even if the prosecutor and the juvenile after waiver thought, you know, maybe this could have been heard in the family court, there was no mechanism to get there. The legislative solution was reverse waiver. And I would submit it would work in the cases that we're concerned about. If there is a motion that is dispositive that probable cause does not exist, how does a prosecutor present that case to the jury? And it is subject to review. It's not unbridled. The jury is going to speak and say, not guilty. If there's no probable cause and it's the only piece of evidence that the state relied upon, there's no chance of conviction. And I would submit that the legislature, in their wisdom, having known about this, incorporated the reverse waiver provision as its safeguard. That's the safeguard against a case being waived that in hindsight, either shouldn't have been waived or that the state cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt. I would also submit to the court that this bright line rule would create uniformity. I mentioned venue in the brief. It's obviously not relevant exactly to this case, other than the venue statute is a good cause determination. And I stand before this court, whether or not waiver is good cause is different around the state. Using phrases like good cause and preference creates disparity. Using a bright line rule creates uniformity. And because due process in a waiver context is important, I would submit the bright line is appropriate, because any consideration of how many co-defendants are there is all subject to change. It changed in this case. The co-defendant was there and now he's out of the case. And all of a sudden that process has changed. And there are decisions that are going to be decided upon factors which change. And I would submit to the court the only way to create uniformity that the due process is required would be the bright line rule. And I would submit that strongly to the court. And then finally, Your Honors, I want to speak for a moment about the practical issues. We talk about judicial efficiency. I would submit to the court that the harm in this case is not upon waiver, because juveniles are routinely kept in juvenile facilities. It is only their behavior that is the criteria for waiving them, for moving them from a juvenile facility to an adult facility. The standard is good cause, but good cause is defined as the best interest of the juvenile and the protection of the public. So there is a structure there, and the federal government has required, and the Attorney General put this in their brief, an interest of justice finding to have a juvenile moved from the juvenile facility to the adult facility. So it is only upon something happening with the behavior of the juvenile where they are putting other individuals at risk in a juvenile detention facility. Again, upon waiver, these are generally, the large majority of juveniles waived are 17 and older. By the time they get to these proceedings, they're 18. If they are creating issues in a juvenile detention facility, which may be holding 14, 15, and 16-year-olds, certainly there's the possibility of them being removed to an adult facility. It is rare. It is rare. When my colleagues and I discussed this for this motion, it rarely happens and is not something that should decide this motion. But there are too many variables I would submit to the court that exist to get into a factor analysis. It's been raised here today. How many hearings are enough? If there is an identification issue and a suppression of physical evidence suppression issue and a Miranda issue, when is it enough? Who decides what's dispositive? Typically, it's the state that decides, is this dispositive to my motion? And again, that's why the JPLN crafted the resolution and remedy that I'm submitting to the court, because the state is considering that subject to judicial review. But if it's a factor, who's making the determination that this is a dispositive motion prior to hearing testimony, prior to listening to one witness testify, and without knowing the entirety and the facts of the case? As I mentioned, these cases are complicated. They have a lot of evidence. They typically have co-defendants. I would submit to the court that the sole defendant waived on one piece of physical evidence is rare, if it exists at all. There are generally co-defendants. There are generally multiple co-defendants, and they generally exist, not within the vacuum of one motion deciding the whole case, but in a very complicated construct of evidence, any one piece of which may not be dispositive. I submitted quite a bit of time on law of the case. In juvenile court, that matters because of the venue change. And when we get into harm, and Your Honor, when we get into judicial economy, juvenile venue is laid where the juvenile resides. But in the adult, it's where the crime occurred. So if I had a juvenile who committed a homicide in Ocean, and I make, but they reside in Monmouth, and I make a good cause motion to retain the case, it may or may not stay in Ocean, because good cause is obviously determined by the court. But if it were to stay or go to Monmouth, and at that point in time, substantive motions are being heard and the case is waived, it would then come back to Ocean. But if it were to remain in Ocean and substantive motions were heard, it may go to Monmouth. You could create a system, I would submit to this court, where all of these complexities are happening, and that is the delay. And that is the harm, because during all of this time, the juvenile is generally sitting in a juvenile detention facility. They are not eligible defendants pursuant to CJR, so they are not speedy trial eligible, and they are waiting for these dispositive motions to take place. They can't walk into the court and resolve their case. They can't plead guilty, because there's obviously case law that prevents the judge from taking a guilty plea on a waiver matter, so they are just there.
and they're there as this case ping-pongs back and forth between counties potentially, or up and down from the appellate division, as was suggested by my colleagues, all the time, not being speedy trial defendants. And I would submit to the court that the JPLN's remedy takes into account the interests of the juvenile, takes into the account the interests of the state in moving these matters. It takes into account the legislative intent of making waiver purposeful, thoughtful, and intentional, and subjecting that to judicial review when the state stands before the court on the abuse of discretion hearing. I also submit, Your Honor, that the harms as outlined in regard to publicity, I would suggest, are solved by the use of protective orders. The state raised a similar concern in NH, and the court obviously set forth that protective orders could be used. There are many juvenile matters, I would submit, where the media does make application to appear. I have handled those, obviously, in the course of my career. So it's not as if juvenile proceedings, even pre-adjudication, are not at times open to the public. However, protective orders are within the bounds of the court's discretion. They're used in juvenile court all the time when a judge says, no, I'm not permitting media to appear. And that can be done in the adult section as well, until and unless a court of competent jurisdiction has decided to no longer have that protective order. Are there any questions from the court?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Denny, brief rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's a lot of talk from opposing counsel about streamlining and expediting how that showed up in the legislative history, which was that it's just one line in the legislative history. And it was really targeted at getting rid of the expensive and lengthy amenability to rehabilitation hearings, as one of my adversaries said. The new waiver statute did do that. It also had the intention to lower the overall number of waivers. It did that by decreasing the number of waivable offenses and increasing the age required for waiver from 14 to 15. Another thing it did was increase the time that the state has to file a motion from 30 days to 60 days. That's an increase of 30 days. The data from the 2016 and 2017 JJC report shows that on average, that motion is filed by the state in 78 days, not even in 60 days. And then moreover, after that motion is filed, it takes 5.5 months for the waiver hearing to actually happen, meaning that from the date of the offense to the date of the waiver hearing, there's 7.5 or close to 8 months. Again, here, I'm not talking about a lengthy and expensive amenability to rehabilitation hearing. This is just a suppression motion, largely probably with police witnesses and not experts. Regarding the overall number of cases, the most recent 2018-2019 report, I think, shows that there's 111 cases and that 40% of those had been withdrawn down to 83 final cases. There'd be suppression motions in some subset of those 83 cases, and then that would be distributed out between the different counties in the state, meaning that any one county is very unlikely to get a large amount of motions to suppress physical evidence.
This case involves physical evidence. Others would involve Miranda, could involve eyewitness identification questions. The bright line that you're seeking, would it apply beyond physical suppression cases?
No, Your Honor. The bright line I'm seeking is just for suppression of physical evidence.
Is there a logical distinction between that and the next case that involves questionable waiver of rights in a Miranda setting?
The reasons that I provide for that are that Article 1, Paragraph 7 gives more expansive protection to violations of search and seizure. And additionally, it often is the only evidence, unlike maybe in another type of case, Miranda, for instance, where there might be a confession, but it's not going to be dispositive because there's eyewitnesses or other types of evidence.
Are you telling us, does the public defender have a position with respect to similar motions that are not involving the physical suppression of evidence, but suppression of other kinds of evidence?
My position today is only asking for suppression of physical evidence.
I fully understand your position today.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that the public defender, I wouldn't want to foreclose some potential opportunity for someone to argue that at a different time.
based on a different set of facts and potentially different issues.
Please go ahead.
Regarding the waiver factors, I think it's more than just the nature and circumstances of the offense. I think suppressed evidence could also affect the culpability of the juvenile and the criminal sophistication of the juvenile, just for examples of additional factors that could be impacted. I'd like to push back a bit on the state's suggestion that the gun or a testimony about the gun would somehow be admissible even if there were to be a successful suppression motion. The case that was cited for that proposition is State v. Little. That case does not involve suppressed physical evidence. It's simply a case that says in order to prove unlawful possession, the state could put forth the gun or put forth testimony from a police officer. There's been no suppressed evidence in that case, and the state is wrong to cite it for that proposition. And finally, just to address the likelihood of success factor advanced by amicus to be included, I guess, in the statute, that was included in the old Attorney General guidelines and was specifically left out when the statute was rewritten in 2015. Our, the appellate division has already considered that in ZS and says that at best consideration of the likelihood of conviction is optional. So the court would have to substantially change the statutory framework as it is in order for that to be something that the state's going to consider as it's suggested. Other than that, I have nothing to add if there's no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Denny. Thank you to counsel.